You're tuned into the Awakening Zone Radio Network, your news and information source for empowered spiritual awakening.
Hi, this is Karen Elkins from Science to Sage Radio, and today we have a couple guests with us. One is Wal Thornhill, and the other is Edward Camp. We're still trying to get Wal on the line, but Edward's with us, and he, at the moment, I'm going to say what this show is about. Science to Sage does a magazine and the radio show, and what we do is each month we feature leading-edge scientists, artists, mystics, and innovative thinkers. And today, we're actually looking at the notion, is our universe electric? And if so, what are the implications for it? And while we're trying to get Wal on the line, we're going to start with Edward, because he and I met at something called the Electric Universe Conference, which Wal Thornhill is where I met Wal. And Evan Camp is an eighth grade science teacher from Indiana. He has been a recipient of a Lillian Teacher Creativity Grant, which has enabled him to investigate plasma astrophysics. And so when he went to the EU conference, he was one of the speakers that was incredibly dynamic, and he was teaching kids something that was quite extraordinary, in that I actually believe we live in an electric universe. And Evan, come on for a second.
Yes.
And talk through. You know, because what you were doing was showing the difference between the old model of school and the new model.
Yes.
of what we teach of the universe. And some of your examples and what you were doing were quite extraordinary. So while we're waiting for Wal to come on the line, why don't you give us some examples of what it was that you did or that you teach that I think is phenomenal. Can you give us some examples?
Sure. At my school, actually, with my 8th grade standards, they had actually been shifted to other grades that deal with astronomy. So I do this as an after-school club, and which also gives me a little bit more freedom to discuss some of these ideas. So what I first do is I lay down the groundwork on what is believed currently about, like, dark matter, dark energy, and things like that, and how scientists currently believe how the universe works, because really, the students do not get this at school at all right now at the level that I teach. They don't get it until their freshman year of high school. So actually, I teach the standard theory first, and then we go through and we discuss certain ideas, whether maybe how the electric sun model works versus the thermonuclear model of the sun, or then we have a day maybe we're comparing comets. And but one of my favorite things to do, as an example, is when we look at whenever you have impacts and you have these craters on the moon or on Mars, and you can look at those, and I love putting up these pictures out and then trying to get these and have students try to come up with what are the different ways that you could have an impact where you'd have this big rise or big bubble in the middle, or where you'd have nearly a straight line where you have these little nodules, where you see the path widen and then narrow and then widen and then narrow. Sometimes, on Phobos, you see this impact on the moon where the impact should, if it was an impact, it should nearly destroy the thing. It looks like it's nearly a quarter of the size of the moon itself. So, with standard theory, excuse me?
Are you thinking that's, like the difference between when there's an impact or there's like electrical discharge that creates this explosion? Explain that.
Well, whenever you look at, like, an impact, you would not expect to see a rise in the middle. Or the way these nodules come out, it's real interesting that with the standard theory, you'd almost have to come up with a completely different explanation for how each one of these impacts would occur. But whenever you have electrical scarring, Zane Parker and a man named T.J. Ransom did experiments in a lab with different type of charged materials. Sometimes the rock body would have, like, a positive or more negatively charged, and you get different effects when they run the electricity, and you have these this arcing hitting this rock. Sometimes it would bubble up, and sometimes it would be depressed a little bit. And they were even able to create these little things they call blueberries, which are on they find these little things that are called blueberries that are on the surface of Mars.
Those little bubbles.
Yes. Yeah, and they're all over the surface, and they've been able to recreate that in a lab. So, and many of these pictures that you see, especially sometimes when you see a crater, and then it right smack dab in the middle of the crater, you'll see something that looks like would have to be an impact. from something else that created something else odd, but it's amazingly symmetrical. And so with electrical scarring, it would make sense that you'd almost have to have some type of coincidence after coincidence after coincidence to create these things over and over and over on lunar surfaces or on the moon Mars.
Evan, what creates the little bubbles? What electrical aspect actually creates the little bubbles?
I don't suppose to be an expert. I'm not an expert on this, but I believe it's the different charges where they're pulling each other, I assume. But I've just been studying, the pictures that Zane Parker and CJ Ransom create in the laboratory, and they're able to do this repeatedly.
With electricity.
Yes, and get many of the dendritic figures that you see, like in certain places on Earth, or even on Mars, where you have these dendritic channels that move across, and they look exactly like bolts of lightning, that you see on the flesh of victims who've been struck by lightning, or whenever lightning strikes a golf course, and they're able to recreate these things that we see here on Earth. That sometimes people wonder if these river channels or canyons are created by water, but yet you see that they look exactly like the way it would if you'd have some type of electrical discharge, like that could be explained as discharge between bodies of like giant planets, perhaps thousands from thousands of years ago.
Wow. So here's a question for you. Let's say that we do live in an electric universe. What are the implications versus what we actually are taught conventionally at this time?
Well, I think I think it's very far-reaching. To be honest with you, like when I was into the studying Big Bang Theory, and I used to have it as one of my standards, and I taught it in class, and taught dark matter and dark energy, and the idea that the universe, starts off with a bang, I'm all right with, as it continues to expand, the idea that dark energy will eventually rip everything apart billions of years from now is, even though I'm not going to personally be around for that, obviously, no one will, it's the idea that it's kind of a depressing idea. And, not to get into too much of the...
doomsday for you.
Yeah, too much of a doomsday, but it's kind of like, no matter what people believe spiritually in any way, like it's still, you have to wonder, what does this mean if you have an immortal soul? I mean, it's this idea, this universe ripped apart, what are you going to do? So, but the idea that the electric universe, is not to get into too much of the spiritual aspect, but just to get into the idea that
this has a mm-hmm. spiritual component, I think big time. So
yeah.
By all means, go for it.
Yeah. It's just the idea that this is, the idea of the universe is infinite and it's ongoing and has been around for a while, and that isn't the thing that really sells it to me, but that's one aspect of it. If you also have the mythological components where you look at Saturn and Venus and the way the ancient people looked at it, and that these weren't just stories, they were telling something about our past, and this has aspects in terms of the way that we can harness energy in the future. We're putting all this money and billions and billions of dollars looking for dark matter and dark energy, and this is going to be pretty important in terms of space travel in the future and what they look for. I mean, there are many things that that I think that anything about the electric universe theory is that they're creating models for this. They have what's called the Sapphire Project right now, where the electric sun hypothesis is completely testable. Where the thermonuclear model of the sun, you cannot create a model for that in a lab and test it. So there could be money that's put into this that to help us understand the universe a lot better. I went to Google and I type in astronomer surprised, and millions of results come up with this. There's probably no other field of study where you have people surprised as often as astronomers. You don't type in historian surprised and get millions of hits the way you do with that, or mathematician surprised, or
Okay, hold on one second. Wall, is that you on the line?
Yes, it is.
Yahoo! Evan, we've got your legend on the line with us.
Yes.
Hi there, Evan.
I love it. Woo! Thank you, Wall. So, this goes back to the whole idea, and thank you, Evan, for hanging in there with me while we're waiting for Wall. And so we're going to keep the conversation going. So I'm going to introduce Wall here for a second, because Wall is an extraordinary human being. He lives in Australia, and he's quite the quintessential gentleman. We've both, Evan and I, have had the pleasure of meeting him. Gold medal in 2010 of the European Tesla Galilee Academy of Science for his work on the electric universe. Wall has been published in numerous scientific journals regarding the electric nature of stars, supernovas, cosmic plasma, and presented in the Natural Philosophy Alliance in a keynote lecture towards the real cosmology in the 20th century. Wall's been influenced by Velikovsky, and there's a story behind that, which I think I'll let Wall sort of jump in with, because it has to do with the whole nature of how we think about the universe and the stories we've been told that maybe we need to rethink. So thank you all for hanging in there with me today and finally making this all happen.
I hope this works.
Linda, we're all good for right now.
Okay. Yeah, my father gave me a book called Worlds in Collision in the early 1950s, and I was at high school then, called Worlds in Collision. Now, that book became a bestseller, and there was a huge controversy generated by it. Because what Velikovsky was proposing was that we don't understand the real nature of the solar system, that there is an electromagnetic dimension other than just gravitational theory, Newton's theory. And within the first few pages of the book, he throws down the gauntlet to scientists, saying that if Newton's ideas are heresy, his law of gravity is sacrosanct, and this book is a heresy. And, of course, the astronomers took the easy way out and just treated it as heresy and dismissed it out of hand. But, of course, Newton himself admitted that he didn't understand gravity. He had an equation which worked, but he made no hypothesis as to why it worked. Now, this is one of the problems that we face in modern science, is that we have equations in physics, which are supposed to, and observed actually, to work. But the explanations behind them, if there are any, are often based on invalid concepts, confused thinking, and contradictions. Now, this is particularly true of
science. There's a ton of those in science, these do.
Oh, sure.
Go ahead, I heard.
Yeah, I could easily get into that subject, but the point about Velikovsky's book was that when I went to university, I thought, now, here's a great opportunity to ask by lecturers and so on about these ideas, because I'd read enough and knew enough about science then to realize that Velikovsky seemed to have made a lot of good arguments, and what's more, his work was interdisciplinary, so it answered questions across a whole range of subjects. And I found that very appealing. Now, when I got to university, I was probably the only physics undergraduate who spent a lot of time in the sociology section of the university library. And the more I read on ancient legends and myths and so on, the stories just sprang out from the page, and I understood, or at least I could gain an impression of the correctness of Velikovsky's idea that the solar system had changed within human memory, and in ways quite dramatic. So, in 1979, I was lucky enough to be in America, and I rang Velikovsky at his home in Princeton, New Jersey, and he invited me and my family up to visit. At that visit, my question for him was, what is it we don't understand about gravity? Because this was the key issue upon which the astronomers rejected his work, their belief that Newton's law was sacrosanct and that somehow Einstein had explained gravity. He gave me a slim volume that he'd written back in the 1940s called Cosmos Without Gravitation, and he gave me the germ of an idea there, and that is that gravity is a kind of leftover electric dipolar force in ordinary matter, but he couldn't go any further than that at that time. So with this idea in my mind, I was attracted to a tiny advertisement in the Scientific American in 1981 called the Journal of Classical Physics, and the very first article was called Electron Structure. Now, according to physics, electrons don't have structure. They're a fundamental particle, whatever that means, and there is no known internal structure. With this simple idea, it was easy to see that you had a repeated pattern. So you go down to the atomic scale and then to the subatomic, and you have the same kind of things happening, but the forces, because they're so much smaller, are also that much weaker. And gravity, one of the puzzles about gravity is that it's such a weak force. It's practically zero compared with the electric force. So here was the clue. And from there, various other great pioneers appeared, like Birkeland with his Torella experiments, which showed that the sun and the connection to the Earth is an electrical phenomenon. Hans Alfvén, who was the Nobel Prize winner in plasma physics and came up with an alternative cosmology based on electrical behavior of plasma, which is something which is ignored by astronomers today. There's no mention of electricity in any textbook on astronomy. And these are the various clues which all went to make up this grand picture, which I call the electric universe.
It's also Nikola Tesla, too, wasn't it? Because you obviously, they liked you. They gave you an award.
Well, the Tesla group were having a meeting right next door to our Thunderbolts meeting last year. And that was very interesting.
Did you
Tesla,
actually cross paths? Were they in Las Vegas too?
Yes, we were sort of in different rooms, but participants in each sort of migrated backwards and forwards.
Okay.
The point about Tesla is I consider him to have been one of these intuitive geniuses who just knows how electricity behaves, so that he was able to almost dream up circuits and that in his mind and then apply them and produce some amazing results. However, there are so many apocryphal stories about what he did do and didn't and maybe did that it's very difficult to uncover fact from fiction. Certainly, I think he was somebody who discovered the longitudinal electric force, which I think is going to be very important in the science of the future. At present, it's not even considered to be important. But from his work, I think we will begin to understand the nature of the real nature of gravity, the electrical nature of gravity, and the real electrical nature of matter.
Well, let me go back and ask a question. You were talking about the dipoles, and some people might not understand what that structure is. Can you explain that a little bit? I know that's basic for you, but I think it's important to your model.
Okay. It is very important because the entire Earth, everything that we see, solids, liquids, and gases, are made up of atoms, which are electrically neutral. However, we know that an atom is made up of positive and negative charge in equal amounts. And the positive and the negative charge can't occupy the same space at the same time. So whenever you have charges separated, a positive and negative charge separated, even by a very tiny distance, they form what's called an electric dipole. Now, chemists are very interested in electric dipoles because they deal with molecules and chemical reactions and so on, which involve the transfer of charge and electric dipoles. In my physics textbook, I went back to have a look, and it's only a very cursory treatment of electric dipole forces, but they are fascinating, and it seems that the force that holds us to the Earth is the same kind of thing as the thing that holds all of the atoms and molecules of the world that we see together. It's the same kind of thing, but at a different level.
Well, that's what I was wondering. When you and I had the conversation before the show a while back, the dipoles remind me of, because when you do the Electric Universe conferences, which I think is interesting, you bring many different disciplines in. And so when I was looking at the structure of water, like when Gerald Pollitt talks about it, there's, again, the positive and negative that even happens within the water, which also water, which carries the charge, right? And even if you look at the structure of the Earth, it also has the same sort of dipole structure, which is still the positive neck, which creates the spin. Is that correct?
And that's
critical to all life.
Well, the separation of charge is crucial to the rotation of galaxies, planets, and also to the chemical reactions. The I lost the train of thought there.
It'll go back, because this is something you and I talked about. It goes back to the whole idea of looking at dark matter. And when you and I were talking, there was no such thing as dark matter. So why don't you go ahead and explain what you were explaining to me? I think that goes back to the whole idea of what we're talking about.
Yeah, before I get on to dark matter, I just mentioned that an electric dipole is very similar to a magnet, which has a north and a south pole. An electric dipole has a positive and a negative pole, and there's an electric field around it, which and also dipoles tend to line up with each other if they're free to rotate. And, of course, in an atom, the subparticles are free to rotate, to line up, and this is what gives the effect of gravity. The entire Earth, all of the tiny dipoles that make up the matter in the Earth, all point outwards, and we're part of that. So we are attracted by that same almost like a magnetic field almost to the Earth. Magnetic fields and gravity are very similar.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Go for it.
Jerry Pollack's work on water, of course, shows the remarkable nature of water and the complexity you can get just by looking at its electric dipole structure. So all of the wonderful complexity we see in the universe can be attributed to very simple dipole effects, electric dipole effects. And this is one of the beauties, I think, of the electric universe cosmology, is that it brings things back to something that's simple and understandable. And when you get to dark matter and so on, that's a symptom when your concepts are invalid to start with. You've made a mistake, but you continue on with the mathematics trying to fit it to what you observe, and you have to invent matter and forces and all sorts of weird things, virtual particles, just to make your maths work. Now, this is not the way science should be done.
Well,
you should start out with concepts which are verifiable by observation, and then work forward and be able to predict things. And as Evan pointed out when I was listening earlier, astronomy in particular, all you hear is surprises. And that's simply because the initial concepts are invalid. They're wrong.
Well, here's the interesting thing to me. When I think of the notion of the dipole, and I think of what we were talking about before, is the idea of the dark matter, there was no such thing, because everything is like a torus field. These fields where things are kind of going in, if you think of the battery, it's kind of coming in and rotating in and out, and in these fields. So it's not dark matter we're looking at. It's actually an electromagnetic, can I say, pulse sort of pattern?
Well, it's even simpler than that. And one of the problems that we've been infected with is the language of modern physics, which is really surreal. All of these words. It's only complicated because the words that are used are generally meaningless. It's as simple as this. Gravities rotate just like an electric motor, a Faraday motor, one of the simplest forms of electric motor you can build. So that gives you the rotation of galaxies. And that's been a puzzle. I mean, there's no answer to that question, why do galaxies rotate, in the standard model of the universe. And it's the same with stars. Stars rotate. Now, stars are born in an electric current, which is twisting, and it's the twist of that that's imparted to the matter by that electric current that generates the rotation of stars, and so on down the chain. So rotation is a fundamental characteristic of electrical interactions. It's sort of an electric motor.
But it's also the fundamental component of life.
Yes, and that's one aspect where the electric universe provides a link to the natural medicines or the natural theories of life, the electrical nature of life, because we're made up of matter.
I've been having fun, Wal, with the last couple issues where it was the electric universe one where I did, where I'd gone to the conference and came back, and then I had that aha about the four forces of nature and the four elements were all electrical. They were all about an electrical conversation in ways that we'd never thought about them before. I mean, if you think about even the current of the air, or that we're grounded to the earth, these are all electrical conversations, and we don't even think about them from that perspective. And then I had to go to the five senses, and the five senses had everything to do with how the electric universe works. So when I looked at it from, I'm going to say from the micro to the macro, because this is the second time I've been to the conference, you see that everything is electric.
Yep. It's just a case of repeated patterns, too, which simplifies things enormously. The thing about the four forces is that the idea of science back in the 19th century was an attempt to simplify things. But then in the early 20th century, things went from good to bad because perhaps with the introduction of the Nobel Prize and big money prizes and that, there was this push to invent new forces and new particles and get a Nobel Prize. The electric universe operates in the other direction. It tries to simplify things. It goes back to the way science was done, the classical physics, if you like, of the 19th century, which was just based less on mathematical speculation and more on plain observation and freewheeling exchange of ideas. There is no freewheeling exchange of ideas these days because of peer review, which means that if you have no peers, they won't review you.
You know, that reminds me, Bruce Lipton, I remember when he came up with his whole idea of epigenetics, he says, I was so excited, and he goes, I gave my speech, and they all walked out on me, and it was very lonely.
That's right,
yeah. Sometimes when you're a groundbreaker, it's very tough to break the ground, because people, I have a 17-year-old son who's going to tell me I'm wrong. So I don't.
That's right.
So here's the question.
We have to take care of human nature, and this is not done when you've taught science at university, and I don't think anyone did a course on philosophy and sociology. Human nature is such that we resist ideas which fundamentally change the stories that we've been taught since we were in childhood. You know, we believed in a flat Earth for how many centuries, and that the Earth was the center of the universe for even longer.
There you go.
These beliefs are very hard to shake.
It does. But here's a question. When I look at, some people might not know what plasma is, but it makes up 99.99% of the universe, the visible universe. So can you kind of explain, at least for some of these people, when we're talking about an electric universe, what is plasma? How do they see it? How do they recognize it? And that's basic. It's important.
Yeah. Well, as I said before, the world that we experience is made up of neutral matter.
Right.
Now, if you take a bit of that neutral matter and you heat it and you keep heating it until it gets so hot that the atoms themselves start to break apart, then you've got a plasma. And it can happen in a candle flame, it happens in lightning, it happens inside fluorescent tubes and so on. Whenever you've got sufficient energy applied to matter, it tends to break up into its constituent parts. So in space, once the charges are separated, the negative electrons are separated from the rest of the atom, which leaves a positively charged residual atom, the particles are so far apart that they tend not to be able to recombine easily. On Earth, of course, there's always interactions which will try and neutralize charge if possible. So in space, that's the realm of plasma. And so most of the universe, 99.99% of the universe, is in the form of plasma. It's only in places like here on the surface of the planet Earth, which has a nice thick atmosphere, that you will experience neutral matter.
Here's my question, Walt, because you guys are saying that the sun is electric, which the question that comes to my mind is, then if everything is electric, then, and we live in an electric universe, then how do I differentiate when I think I'm human and I'm special versus saying, like when you have the conference, Dr. Wei Min Ho says, we live in a universe which is all alive, and it's all electric, and how do we think we ourselves are so special when you talk about how the structure of the universe is, then we're all basically kind of dancing together.
Yes. there was a scientist, Ernst Mach. I'm not sure when he died. It would have been the early 20th century, I think. He said that all matter is connected, and this is what gives rise to inertia. You know, the fact that you try and move, but as soon as you try and move, the rest of the universe is connected to you, so you're trying to pull it with you, so you feel this massiveness. That's where mass comes from. Now, the electric universe simply says that the force that connects everything is the electric force. And what's more, it operates in real time. And that can easily be proven because, for instance, the Earth orbits the Sun exactly where the Sun is right now, not where it was 8.5 minutes ago. And the same for the other planets. You know, Jupiter orbits the Sun where it is now, not where it was 30 minutes ago. And this can easily be shown. So Einstein's idea that the speed of light is a limiting speed of communication between particles, matter, is incorrect. And that has produced all sorts of inconsistencies and incoherence in modern physics. And in fact, life itself would be incoherent if we had to rely on the speed of light connection between the molecules in our body, because there is, I don't know how many trillion chemical reactions going on at any moment in your body, and it all has to be coordinated so that you form this wonderful living creature. And you can't do that with slow speed of light signaling. So the electric universe points the way to the fact that we are connected to the universe in real time, and because we're made similarly, we are strongly connected to each other. In fact, identical twins are the most strongly connected of all, because they, even their molecular structure is exactly the same, so the connection is stronger. And it's all by electrical resonances. It's as simple as that.
Well, you had Rupert Sheldrake at the conference as well, and he was quite he was quite someone who amused all of us. But you made a conference, you made a comment at the conference, and it related to the fact that there's resonance, and in many biblical and ancient texts, they talk about I have many mansions. So you said, you know, maybe there's dinosaurs someplace else. You know, they don't necessarily differ from here, but their resonance may be different, and there's someplace else happening. So you want to explain your thought about that? Because that goes back to that whole thing.
Yes, well, it seems that information is held in these matter resonances. It's not a biochemical thing. It's something which exists in the universe. And as Rupert Sheldrake's work has shown, he actually does the experiments to test these ideas. There is a subtle connection between us and things outside the body. So it raises the issue of, well, where is memory and where is consciousness? Well, it's it's a part of the universe, if you like, and we just represent part of that consciousness. It also suggests that life will form anywhere in the universe where the conditions are right for that kind of life.
For that kind of resonance, is what you're saying.
Yeah, for that kind, yeah.
Okay.
The very fact that on Earth we find the weirdest animals in the most strange places, and you wonder how on Earth did they develop to live in such an environment, like those at the bottom of the ocean, at the mid-oceanic ridge, in these fumaroles, which are sort of volcanic outbursts at the bottom of the ocean, and they find living creatures down there living on sulfur. This is very hard to explain by random mutation. In fact,
you know
I think
Fred Hoyle
calculated.
Yeah.
Well, it's all electrical. It's all this subtle electrical signaling, because this signaling, I should point out, because it's longitudinal, is not shielded. So this is why you can put ESP experiments inside a Faraday cage. That's an electrical cage which shields you from all electromagnetic radiation. And yet ESP still seems to work. It's because you cannot shield it. It's the same signaling that the stars and planets use to maintain their orbits. It's the same thing as gravity. They're all the same kind of force. So that there's no way of shielding us from something else in the universe just by interposing metal walls or concrete bunkers or anything. And this interconnectedness, of course, I think... points to a more hopeful universe, one which has some point, some meaning to us. People often say that they don't have, or they can't find a meaning in their life or why they're here. Well, I would suggest that why we're here is to observe, to learn, and the universe through us learns about itself. And it's a progressive thing.
Yep, I like that one. I think the more I've done the work, the more I've realized that we are creators. We do bring charge to our own realities by the thing that we do. And I think I go back to that whole electromagnetic force idea is wherever that charge is, positive or negative, that's truly what does manifest. And that actually is what drew me to the conference in the first place, is Greg Braden's work. And so that's how I actually showed up on your doorstep a few times. And I do think that the whole idea of being creative, there was something that struck me in the last issue I did, which had to do with Walter Russell's work. And he basically said, we do live in an electric universe, and part of our own nature of becoming masters is we are generally stimulus response. Like if you look at how animals respond, it's that way. But as we become more mindful, and we become in control of the charge, that that's where mastery over the elements, which again are electric and magnetic in nature, even from the way we sense things, which are chemical, or whether it's our tongue, which is, it's all that electric light, how we see, how we hear, they're all the all pulses of that electric universe. It's an electric light show, is what I call it.
Yes.
And the mastery over that, where we become the mover of elements. This is what shamans do, or the rishis have done and still do. I mean, I think that's an interesting sort of thing to aspire to be able to become your own master.
I think that's one of the hopeful aspects of Rupert Sheldrake's work is that his notion of morphic resonance, that once an idea has been thought of, it's easier for others to think of the same thing. And I'm hoping that's true, because the more people who think about the electric universe, the easier it will be for newcomers to pick it up.
Well, it is, but you know what? I'm going to go back to the idea of that each one of us is like our own battery. We're our own battery pack, and how we charge it or don't charge it. But in the middle of it is that core essence, which I think, you know, I saw something that showed a model of an electric component where the outside was the electric field and the inside was the magnetic. And with the work that HeartMath does, they basically say your heart is the strongest force, which is what you magnetize to your world. And that electric field is that radio station that you're kind of walking around going, hey, I get that person's vibe, and this is what I'm sending out. And we attract the things that are more like us. But in that core of it all is still the biggest attractor, which is the magnetic field, which when I think of your notion of gravity, that's what gravitates to you. I was thinking in my unscientific way, are those two sort of similar?
Well, the connection is electric in every case. Magnetism is another version of the electric force. Gravity is a version of the electric force. So you don't need to invent other forces. All you need to do is to understand the behavior of matter electrically in an electric field. And if you think that with science in the 20th century, of course, we went down to the atom. We sort of worked our way down and figured out how an atom might look. All you need to do is suggest, well, this pattern works at this level. Maybe there's another level down. Yeah, maybe the protons and the electrons and that make up the atoms also have structure. Now, it's accepted that the proton has structure, but nobody has thought about the electron. And yet a leading physicist said, if we could find structure in an electron, that would be one of the biggest breakthroughs in science that he could think of. And I agree. But if you just postulate that, it is possible to advance science without actually witnessing what's inside an electron. In fact, it may be impossible to witness what's inside an electron. But by just saying, let's apply the repeated pattern down into the subatomic realm, all sorts of things suddenly open up and become simple to understand. When you go in the other direction, you go from our scale on Earth up to the solar system and to galaxies and then to clusters of galaxies and so on, you use another repeated pattern, and that's electric discharges in a thin gas, which has been shown to mimic all of the weird things that we see in deep space. So we don't have to invent unseen things and unseen energies and all this kind of stuff to explain what we see.
Well,
and
you know,
having done
me...
that, it's quite possible to predict also what you will see and also to explain things very simply without adding extra barnacles on the theory.
Well, let me throw this one thing in, because this was, when you talk about visualizing things, I think that when I started paying more attention, where before it was like I was blind to it, when somebody hasn't seen something, but I think what was fascinating to me is my fingers, the way my whole body is structured, is like an electric current, and it has those proportions of the golden mean. And when I look at, when you're in an airplane and you look down and you notice how water runs off of a mountain, it is absolutely identical to that. And the way the trees grows, it's identical. So then you begin to say that the whole construct of the universe is that way. It's literally discharging that way. And you see a picture of the brain, and it actually has a tree branch in it. Your dendrites, everything about your neural network is electric. And so
I think it's
the mastery is taking command of the charge. So I'm going to hold on one second. You know what? Here's a question. Evan, are you there?
Yes.
You know what? Why don't you? Because you know what? I know that Wall is your hero, and you're out there in the field. You're actually out there with kids and eighth graders, and you're trying to show them what it is that's different. And I think what's really interesting is when you show them the model, they just think it's common sense. Why don't you explain how you do that with these youngsters so that, you know, Wall knows that at the end of the day, something's happening out there for him. He's going to have some young warriors.
Well, I think what it is, it becomes almost intuitive in a while because even when we get into the basics of just chemistry, when I teach kind of my introductory chemistry to my students in eighth grade, you know, we'll start off with things, just the shape of molecules, and we'll talk about how water is a polar molecule. And even when you wash dishes, you know, you have this polar molecule of water grabbing hold of it to the positive end of soap, and the soap sticks into the dirt or grime you're trying to wash. So even when you're washing dishes, or you're actually using magnetism to clean your dishes or clean your clothes, and when you're breathing air, you know, oxygen is just an electron acceptor. So even when you're breathing, in some way, you have to deal with the electric force and just electrons moving from point A to point B just to stay alive. And so when we say everything is electrical, it's true. Like, everything comes down to magnetism. Even just putting food in the microwave, the microwaves grab a hold of the water, since it's a polar molecule, and it just spins it around a billion times a second until you get enough friction to create heat. So anytime you use the microwave, it's magnetism. So when the idea of the electric universe is introduced to the students, by that point it's like, yeah, everything's electrical because everything's made up of atoms. And like Walt said earlier, you know, it's dipolar. You know, there's a dipole there that creates this difference, these differences that makes the world work. You know, it's just electrons moving from point A to point B, and even just in eating food and creating energy like ATP. So it's not that far of a reach, I guess.
No, there's another thing that mystified me, the first electric universe. It was the notion of what they called the pinching. And I was like, yeah, so what? But what was the so what to me, when I look at the idea of a torus field, and when you have that pinching, it's like you take something into a funnel like a tornado, which is also the same thing, and you get that matter down until all of a sudden we're condensed. So it's almost like we get funneled. The matter gets funneled into a place where it can be compacted, like here's my body. And then, like, everything is liquid, solids, and gases, and it goes back out again. So there's this constant dance of the universe, of itself at play, creating and experiencing itself. Would that be part of the electric universe model?
Yeah, certainly.
Sorry, guys, that's not very scientific.
Well,
but
you
think
touched
it's pretty
on a number
basic.
Of things. You touched on a number of things there. As I've said to many people, to have a real cosmology, you can have no exceptions. There must be some connection in the big picture that of how the universe works for any subject you like to mention. And you mentioned tornadoes and funnels, vortexes, and so on. And this is a natural feature of electric currents flowing in matter. But one of the things that you find in our science is because there is no mention of electricity in astronomy, there's no thought that there's any electrical power input to the Earth and its weather systems. And yet what do we see? We see huge masses of air rotating, and in some cases creating giant storms, and a lot of electrical activity above and below those huge storms. It's just a part of the circuit which the sun is the focus.
No pun intended.
You know?
Yep.
Yeah. So when we talk about, for instance, climate change, we have the modelers working, and one of the major power inputs is missing in their models. So I wouldn't take any predictions by climate scientists as being the possible outcome for the future. They're working with faulty models because they've been handed them by experts in another field. And this is one of the critical differences between the electric universe and the way science is done today. There is no specialization necessary in the electric universe. In fact, the more people talk to one another and consider themselves broad experts, the better for science.
Well, here's a funny. I have a brother who lives in Denver, and they're all kind of laughing because they keep getting snow, and they said, are you sure this is like global warming? And I've heard many scientists say that, you know what, I think it's more about taxation than it is really about the model. They think we're actually going into a minor mini ice age from what I've heard. Is that...
I think your model doesn't include taxation. Yeah. Well, the problem is that no one understands how ice ages start or end. So to take predictions about ice ages is also just listening to fairy stories. Yeah.
There is part of a cyclical, I mean, when I think of nature, there's cyclical cycles of things that happen. So like there's the sun has its eruptions every 11 years-ish, those kinds of things. So wouldn't that help somewhat give us some insights?
Yes, but you have to be careful about your model of what's causing the cycles. In the case of the sun, no one knows at present what causes the cyclical behavior. The electric universe provides an answer, and the answer is probably not palatable to most because it says you cannot predict what the sun will do next. And the very fact that climate is obviously undergoing some changes right now is the first place you look is the sun. And what's been happening recently, the sunspots have more or less disappeared. There has been some talk of us going into what's called the Maunder minimum, where you have no sunspots for an extended period. Now, whatever's happening on the sun has a big influence on what happens on the Earth, because our weather and the so-called weather on the sun, because that's what the sunspot cycle is, a weather cycle, are directly related.
Well, there was a thought that was coming to my mind when you're talking about unpredictability and kind of where we started back with the idea of Velikovsky, and it makes me think of years ago when you look at ancient building, people used to build in mounds to protect themselves, or you look at some of the things from the southwest or even in the Middle East where you see buildings or housing that was built into the rocks. And
yes.
I thought to myself, there must be a reason for that, because why would you go hide? Or you would create something that was so, you know, fortress or hiding. So I know there has to be something with Velikovsky's thoughts about that, and I know you understand them. You want to explain some of that when you think about unpredictability?
Yes, the problem is that we've sort of imbued with this story from very early on that the solar system is like clockwork. And that it was wound up 4.5 billion years ago and has ticked along steadily since. The strange thing is, and astronomers, if they're honest, recognize that Newton's law does not guarantee stability. In fact, the exact opposite. It guarantees for more than two bodies, which is the solar system. We've got many more than two bodies orbiting one another. the system is chaotic, because if one body departs slightly from its orbit, there is nothing to restore it. There's no force to restore it. So one of the major problems that I faced, and it took me decades to sort it out, was how do you achieve a nice, orderly, stable solar system after what Velikovsky described, which involved, for instance, Venus being a huge comet, the archetypal comet in prehistoric skies. And then today it's got the most circular, stable orbit in the solar system. The answer finally came to me, and that is, and this is the title of our book, The Thunderbolts of the Gods. When you exchange charge between planetary bodies, or even between a planetary body and a comet or a huge meteor entering the Earth's atmosphere, you will get electrical discharges, and those discharges change the gravity of the apparent mass of that object. And this gives a feedback mechanism which steadies everything, and also tends to avoid collisions. So this paints a whole different picture of the history of the solar system and of the Earth and of the human race. I know in Australia we have one of the oldest indigenous populations, the Australian Aborigines, and their stories of the dream time are precisely that of an encounter with another planetary body. And the exchanges that occurred, the rainbow serpent in the sky, which created the landforms, they're told in ways which are actually probably closer to the truth than a lot of the myths and legends that have been massaged down the centuries by so-called Western or advanced cultures.
Explain the rainbow serpent. That comes up in a lot of cosmology, or not cosmology, in mythologies and stuff. And
the serpent.
It does, and it's everywhere, and it's been, whether it's the I'll call it the dragon in the Chinese, or
yes.
Look at, or even our Adam and Eve stories. I mean, it's like one of those ones that's in 100 different cultures.
Yes.
Seems. But can you give me more of a clue on that? Because that's one thing I've always been curious about.
Yes. Well, this is one of the techniques that Velikovsky used, which was an eye-opener for me and for many other scholars, and that is a forensic approach to unreliable witness reports. And you could treat the ancient stories as, in that fashion, as unreliable witnesses. What you do is you look for repeated patterns which are expressed in different ways by the different cultures, but which have the same features. And one of the archetypes, of course, is the dragon, the fire-breathing dragon.
Yep.
And the Australian rainbow serpent of the dream time is certainly this thing in the sky, which was dramatic. It was serpentine, and which had effects on the Earth's surface, which were dramatic. The Chinese symbolism is excellent. The very earliest dragon had no legs. It was just a fiery-looking object which had a ball, a planetary ball, either in its claw or in its mouth or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the imagery is all there. It's just that we have rather regarded it as fanciful stories without questioning what it actually meant.
We have a question.
When you do piece it together, yeah. It makes sense. But you have to do it in this forensic style, you know, where you only stick to those archetypes that you can be pretty certain have plenty of evidence to back them up.
Okay, I have a question. In the ball that the dragon had, was it like the same ball that the lion has in the paw in China?
Yes.
Because it has. Okay, that's interesting. Because that is. You know what that is, don't you?
No, you can tell me.
Yeah, I'm sure you know what that is. But you know what shows up is the flower of life. And
mm-hmm.
when you actually look at it, you can, and you look at chemistry structures, it's the same variations of ways that everything dances. It's actually the same way that the embryo evolves. And so you can see those, that the ancients, it wasn't just in China, Turkey, Egypt,
yep.
You can see it in the dream catchers that they have in the Americas. So this was
yes.
a ubiquitous
yep.
symbol that showed the cosmos and the structure of life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm hoping for the day when I'm looking forward to the day when we can do an IMAX theatre presentation of what the ancients witnessed in the sky, because people will see the archetypes just spring out at them.
Well, you know what just flashed in my mind? It's like to put the flower of life with the structure of electricity, and the dragon is to show that everything unfolds in a electrical discharge nature that has the structure of life, and that it is the way that things dance. It's like a minefield.
Yeah, that flower of life.
That goes back to
life,
the whole notion of ether, yeah. And that the ether is just a minefield of charge.
Be careful there.
I'm sorry. Okay. I'm pushing it too far, am I? Sorry, Walt.
The flower of life is a plasma discharge phenomenon. And this is where the real key to it all and the more or less solid evidence came from, once we understood the forms of plasma discharges that can be found in the highest energy electrical experiments on Earth, particularly at Los Alamos, the Z-pinch machine.
Wow.
Where you see these wonderful patterns form, and these are the things that were chiseled in rocks by our prehistoric forebears, and which have never been understood. All those weird stick figures and things that look like spacemen and astronauts, they are all forms of plasma discharge, and which is the evidence that the ancients actually witnessed phenomenal electrical exchanges between planetary bodies within the existence of the human race on Earth. The story is quite amazing.
Well, I think that's an interesting one, because that's all part of Dave Talbot, who's your partner in the Thunderbolts Project. That's his sort of area of expertise.
Yes, and that was the marriage of the history of the human race and the science to explain it. My side trying to explain it in scientific terms, and Dave Talbot and other colleagues were involved in trying to piece together the real story of the human race, which is just amazing.
Well, you guys are doing an amazing job in what you're pioneering, and all the things that you're doing to advance our understanding, because I think just not even, it's the whole nature of who we are, and I think it goes back to the shamans. I think it goes back to who we are as people, and that we actually have more free agency if we choose to, and if we understood this, it will change the way. I think if I get the essence of your website, it's not just that it's an electric universe, it's just that let's make a better planet, and if we understand this, life would be better.
That's right. Yes. One of the big fears of Velikovsky, and it appeared in his last book, Mankind in Amnesia, was that mankind in general is behaving like an amnesic patient who has suffered some terrible event in their life, and therefore they suppress the memory. And I think, and he said, the human race has suppressed the doomsday memory. You know, we face the destruction of the Earth. This is what we thought was happening. And we've never actually recovered from it. What we've done is we've suppressed it, and we've made stories around it. And the danger is that somebody in that state, amnesic state, will tend to irrationally try and recreate the events, but often on other people. So this is, you can see, our warlike behavior, which is quite irrational. It comes from that, our separation of people into believers and non-believers of whatever belief it happens to be, comes from the same place, because those who survived thought that those who were destroyed brought the destruction on themselves because they didn't believe the same as they did, that kind of thing.
Yep.
Well, once you begin to understand that, and this is what Velikovsky said, the question was asked, can you put the entire human race on the couch, so to speak? And he said he felt
like
that it was absolutely essential that we understand our past, and this is the way you heal the damage for an amnesic patient, is to gradually introduce the story, the real what happened, and that way the person can learn to deal with it. The human race has to learn to deal with its catastrophic past. Otherwise, we'll have no future.
Yeah, that's true. Evan, we're about, the show's about ready to wrap up. Is there anything you want to add in and before we close?
Yeah, I just think that this is this paradigm that he's talking about is just one of those things that, you know, like I know that some people are, you know, afraid perhaps to kind of introduce some of these ideas in school settings early on. But like I said, when I have it with my kids and I discuss it with them, I think it is something that is really intuitive. It's much simpler. You know, you don't have to come up with these ad hoc explanations. And it's just kind of fun, too. Like, I think it brings mystery back to science. A lot of times sitting in the classroom, when you know you're giving them information that is just pretty much straightforward, black and white, this is what we know, this is why we know it, it's not as interesting. But all of a sudden when you introduce an idea that opens up a whole new world, and especially when I bring in mythology, there are some kids that would come to the Electric Universe Club on some days, and then we'll be talking about the electric sun one day. They're like, well, I'm not going to come today when we talk about the electric sun, but I do want to come next time you talk about Mars. And when they know I'm going to be talking about the symbols and mythology and the Saturn myth and stuff like that, like, you're just hooked in by a certain aspect of it that deals with the mythology and the human story. So there are a lot of people that are just really that just love the human aspect of it rather than just the pure science aspect of it. So it's really something that no matter what you're into, there's something for you in it.
Yeah, well, I think the interesting part, I think when we start getting into people's belief systems as far as when it comes to religion, it becomes very touchy because it challenges a lot of things. So, I mean, I had some gentleman who emailed me today and said, well, you know, you probably won't believe this because you're not Muslim, but you know what? We believe it's all one all is God. And I go, well, it has to be because it comes from one source and it's all part of the rainbow, which I know is part of that religion. And I think, but that shouldn't be a Muslim belief, that's just a scientific thing, too, and I think God is the best scientist around. So I think it all kind of goes together. I don't think it's separated. So go ahead. Wal, you had something you wanted to say.
Yes, I think what Evan is doing in education is important. As he said, the tendency is to just dish out facts for the kids to remember. A lot of things which are so-called facts should be presented as questions, and they should be given the opportunity to think for themselves, to compare what happened in the past, because a lot of the things that we are taught now were merely decided on a show of hands, and this is not how science should be done. It's not a democracy. You have to determine what is real from what is not. So providing kids with, for instance, the history of ideas, the real history, not the sort of sanitized version that we get, you begin to realize that there were some brilliant minds in the past who argued against what we now believe, but who were totally ignored. And the arguments are just fascinating. So, you know, without a real history of science, we're doomed to keep repeating the same mistakes.
I totally agree. And you know what? Both of you guys have been phenomenal. Both of you are doing brilliant work, and it's so important, I think, for our own, I'm going to say, evolution and revolution of the planet right now, because it will fundamentally change our understanding of who and what we are, how we can actually control our own beingness and become our own shamans, and at the same time, understand the universe as it actually is. So with that, I want to say thank you so, so much for being on the show. Evan, I hope you had fun because you got to be with your legend.
That's right.
There you go. And while you've always been a pleasure, and it's always been nice, you're such a gentleman. And so thank you both. And with that, we're going to say goodbye. And I just want to also say both of you have contributed. Evan, I didn't take your contribution because when you sent me the PowerPoint, there was something so dynamic about you that I thought I should leave it intact and whole. So if anybody wants to see the Electric Universe issue that we just did, I mean, you can see his whole PowerPoint, how he's actually a tour de force in the school system. And we have links and links and links. If you go to the Electric Universe, the Thunderbolts Project, you will find these gentlemen. There's tons of resources. Don't miss out, because it is something fundamentally mind-blowing and very progressive. So thank you guys for joining me on the show. Thank you, Wal. Thank you, Evan.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks, Evan.
And we'll, Yeah, and we'll do it again sometime. Thank you. And there we go. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Awakening Zone Radio Network, offering insights and inspiration for our evolving consciousness.